Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, hi there. So welcome to today's edition of Explaining History podcast. Today we're going to be talking about the February Revolution in Russia. And before we get into it, I think there's just a few basic things to be said on the subject. The difference between the February Revolution in 1917 and the October Revolution in 1917 is that the February Revolution is not pre-planned, really, in any way. And it's not really led by any one political party, at least not at first. It's a spontaneous people's revolution. And really, the people who begin the February Revolution aren't even thinking in terms of revolution at all. It starts out as a bread protest on the 23rd of February 1917. The food shortages that I talked about in the last podcast, when we talked about World War One, really begin to bite in late 1916 to early 1917. There has been a very, very bitterly cold winter. And by the 19th of February, the government announces that they may have to start rationing in March. And this is more than the public anger it can tolerate at the time. On the 23rd, frustration and anger at the long queues for bread and at the empty shops that used to be full of all sorts of nice things, such as bread and cake and pie and sausage and all those sorts of things, the public anger boils over and it's women. And it just so happens, by coincidence, that it's International Women's Day on February the 23rd. But this is not necessarily related. This wasn't, again, as I said, it's not a political protest. But it happens it's International Women's Day, and it is the women queuing up for bread who eventually demand that their husbands, many of whom work at the giant Putilov steelworks, come out on strike with them. The beginnings of the February Revolution can be seen on the 23rd as the protesters begin to clash with police. By about lunchtime, some 100,000 workers have downed tools and are on the streets. And at this point, there's no suggestion on the part of the authorities that they appear or believe that they have lost control at all. The attack by the Tsar's police, who use horse whips and the flats of their sabres against protesters, only serve to radicalise the protest. So very quickly we go from a protest about food to the focus of the protest being about the Tsarist regime. And on that morning, we start to see the very first signs that the army, particularly the Cossacks, who are the Tsar's cavalry, are becoming progressively unwilling to attack the crowds. There are far too many of them, for starters. And also, there's a memories of 1905 fresh amongst the troops. And also a sense that really it is a very morally questionable and deeply unpatriotic thing to do. On the 24th and the 25th, the crowds come out again, and they have swelled to 150 to 200,000, and they're becoming emboldened. When they start to realise that the police and the army can't really do anything, and even the thousands of new troops that have been drafted into Petrograd, they can't really do anything, it gives them an awful lot of confidence. A lot of the workers cross into the wealthier districts of Petrograd, across the Nevsky Bridge, and they're looking to loot. Many of them have woken up that morning and listened to socialist agitators who, whilst not really being part of the Bolshevik Party, in fact, very, very, very few Bolsheviks are present at the time, nonetheless, there are people from all manner of radical fringe parties trying to politicise and radicalise the workers. Though I would imagine a great many of the workers were thinking of their food shortages and under the assumption, often correct, that the rich districts and their shops had lots of easy pickings. On Sunday the 25th, an entirely different tone can be heard. There's a virtual general strike, and the banners are now not saying "Give us bread," but "Down with the Tsar." Red flags can be seen unfurled all over Petrograd, and the clashes with the police become progressively more frequent and more violent. The officers in Cossack regiments were starting to find that it was increasingly difficult to get men to obey their orders, and they knew that very serious orders were inevitably on the way. In one incident, perhaps an apocryphal tale, on the Nevsky Prospect, the main boulevard through Petrograd, the Cossacks came up against a crowd of workers and were supposedly going to fire on them. But the intervention of a young girl who walked out between the two groups and presented the commanding officer of the Cossacks with a bouquet of roses, which he gratefully accepted with a smile, led to the workers referring to the Cossacks as comrade Cossacks, which gives us a clear idea as to whose side they're now on. The Tsar's Council of Ministers, at every hand's turn in this process, believed that moderation was the key to calming the situation down, and that they held back from open confrontation with the crowds, because that was just the spark that a full revolutionary outbreak needed. Unfortunately, the Tsar himself was not really listening to this advice. In a way, he was a victim of the beliefs of his ministers, who were consistently playing down the seriousness of what was happening. They suspected that if they gave him a full picture, then he would order a massacre. The Tsar himself was at Mogilev, which was in Belorussia and several hundred miles away from Petrograd, and had little knowledge of the full situation of the protests. It's an interesting point that what kind of modern government, if we can call it modern, has this lack of communication? And the answer is that, well, the Tsar's kind. That the lack of communication, the lack of an ability of the Tsar to know something so fundamental as this, really is an indicator of the regime's weakness. On Sunday morning, the inevitable happens and shooting begins. The worst incident was by a training detachment of the Volinsky Regiment, who fired into a crowd. These were young, inexperienced soldiers. They fired into a crowd of workers, killing 50. And this was really, in the minds of the workers of Petrograd, the second Bloody Sunday. And this is the turning point for the revolution. This is where you can actually start talking of it as a revolution, not a series of protests. This is where the workers' determination, a collective determination to rid themselves of the Tsar once and for all, begins. And the fact that the orders appear to have come from the Tsar to fire on the people, whether they did or they didn't, is immaterial. The perception is that they did, means that the Tsar finally, at last, is viewed, as he had been in 1905, as an enemy of the Russian people. Many of the young cadets and soldiers, horrified by what they had done, examined their consciences on Sunday. By Monday, had moved over to the side of the people. Further repression had been ordered, and they were unwilling to carry these orders out. Many of them shot their officers, and by Monday, the revolution is becoming armed and militarised. And again, this is a fundamental change in the revolution that made it more serious and more dangerous than the Tsar in 1905. Because once you have the army equipped and armed and arming the people, that's when you really have lost control. And the situation becomes worse for the Tsar's government when the arsenal in Petrograd, at the Petrograd garrison, is overcome by soldiers and workers who take away a haul of 40,000 rifles and 30,000 revolvers. And then when they take over some of the arms factories in Petrograd, another 100,000 guns fall into the hands of the people. And this presents the new growing revolution with an interesting angle, in that now the general populace in Petrograd is armed. They're not necessarily going to do all the things. It's not necessary that all the things they're going to do are going to be dedicated towards the overthrow of the Tsar. A great deal of crime and violence breaks out in Petrograd, and there's a great deal of arbitrary murder and score settling now that people are armed. The nobles in particular in Petrograd during the February Revolution were in great danger. Small squads of soldiers who had mutinied and who had realised that there was no law or authority to control them marched around and dispensed their own kind of revolutionary justice. They, without any authority from any government, because there isn't one, arrested nobles, looted their houses, came to take any guns that they could find. There seems to be particular interest in finding firearms of any nature. Would take pot shots at wealthy-looking people walking down the street. Anyone wealthy was now translated into being this idea of being an enemy. The corruption of the word bourgeois was bourgeois, and if you're a bourgeois, then that meant you were enemy. You don't have to have read Karl Marx, you don't have to have read Lenin, you don't have to have any kind of understanding of any kind of politics at all to know that wealthy means enemy. And the idea of the wealthy was also mixed up with the idea of other enemies, such as the Germans or, in peasant Russia, the Jews, who were obviously the focus of much of the hatred of the peasantry a lot of the time. Something worth noting is that every political party in Russia is taken by surprise by the revolution, particularly the Bolshevik Party, because the majority of Bolsheviks are not in Russia at the time. Leon Trotsky is in New York, Lenin and most of the Bolsheviks are in Switzerland, and the only Bolsheviks that are in Russia are people like Stalin, who is in exile in Siberia. Lenin had famously said a couple of months before the revolution to a gathering of young revolutionaries in Switzerland that really it would be them who would carry the torch of revolution onwards, and it was unlikely to happen in his lifetime. Lenin was a famous hyper.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Chondriac and was convinced that he was going to die within the next few years. In fact, he does, but for entirely different reasons. And he had no idea that literally within 8 or 9 weeks, the revolution he dreamt of for most of his life would have arrived. And the two political bodies that emerged from the February Revolution are the Provisional Government and the Petrograd Soviet. Now, this is something of a difficult area for many students who study the Russian Revolution. Why has Russia suddenly got two governments? Well, on one hand, the Provisional Government is a meeting of the Duma that refuses to dissolve itself on the Tsar's request during World War I. These are the ministers that, despite the Tsar's demands, just don't go away. And on the other hand, the Petrograd Soviet is, as we know, Soviet means council or committee, and the Petrograd Soviet is a congress of all the deputies of all the small Soviets across Petrograd. So every factory, an army regiment, and any institution that elects itself a Soviet to decide what to do with itself sends a deputy, one of its members, to a meeting of all the Soviets in the Tauride Palace. Now, in the right wing of the Tauride Palace sits the Provisional Government, and in the left wing sits the Petrograd Soviet. And we have these two bodies. The Petrograd Soviet has a great air of legitimacy because people have voted. Men in army regiments have voted for their deputy to go to the Petrograd Soviet, as have people in factories. And they can claim that it is representative of the majority of ordinary people across the city. Whereas the Provisional Government hasn't got that. The Provisional Government hasn't been elected by anybody. It's kind of appointed itself. It is noticeably full of gentry and nobles. And it doesn't really appear to have any kind of mandate to rule. But the point is that it doesn't want to. The Provisional Government isn't there really to rule in the long term, hence the title Provisional. All the Provisional Government is there to do is to be a caretaker government that will hold things together, hold the country together, until there is a general election to decide the future government of the country. Now, this presents the country with a number of key problems. Major issues such as the war, the land question, and the future direction of Russia in general can't really be decided by a government that hasn't got any mandate, but they must be decided. And the Petrograd Soviet has a number of demands to make of the provisional government before it will offer it its support. You've got to bear in mind that the Petrograd Soviet not only control all the soldiers and sailors in Petrograd, but they also control the post office, the electricity generation, they control all the major industry, the railways, they control the ports and the allowing the food in and out of the city. What anything useful, they've got. So they demand an immediate amnesty for all political prisoners. So even if they didn't want to have to invite the Bolsheviks back into the country or let them out of jail, now the provisional government has to do it. They demand an immediate granting for freedom of speech, press and assembly. So Bolshevik newspapers can now go into print. The abolition of all restrictions based on class, religion and nationality. The immediate preparations for the creation of a constituent assembly elected on universal suffrage. The abolition of police bodies. So all the police force, all the people to police the peasants in the countryside and to police the cities are now abolished. Whilst these are perhaps not particularly pleasant people, they're essential to keeping the state secure. And in their place, a people's militia with elected officers responsible for the organs of local self to the organs of local self-government must be created. So a kind of a revolutionary police force must be created instead. One that perhaps isn't going to look upon serving the provisional government very favourably. And the guarantee that military units having taken place in the revolution would neither be disarmed nor sent to the front. So now soldiers will not be sent back to the front to fight, but they will be allowed to hang on to their guns and they will be allowed to dominate the streets of Petrograd. Again, not a very healthy environment for the provisional government to thrive in. Now here is a little extract from the Tsar's diary on the 26th of February 1917. It's interesting, and think about, cast your mind back to what was happening on the 26th of February 1917. Here he is at Mogilev. He writes, "At 10 o'clock I went to Mass. The reports were on time. There were many people at breakfast, including all the foreigners. Wrote to Alex, his wife, and went for a walk near the chapel by the Bobrisky Road. The weather was fine and frosty. After tea, I read and talked with Senator Trigubov at dinner. Played dominoes in the evening." What's wrong with this picture? Well, the thing that's immediately wrong with it is he doesn't mention that there is a revolution in his capital city and his government is on the edge at all. In some ways, I mean, you could argue that he wasn't being fully informed of the facts, but he knew enough. He had spent his time during the war at this forward command, or Stavka, and not very much had happened there. He had spent much of his time playing dominoes, reading books, going for walks and having chats with people, but not very much had been done to actually prosecute the war against Germany. And certainly when the revolution breaks out, even less is done to try to kind of comprehend what's going on. Obviously, the death of Rasputin had had a profound effect on Nicholas and forced him to become this kind of even more quiet, introspective character who had completely lost control of events. The following day, when the Tsar hears that a mutiny has broken out in Petrograd, he comes up with a rather limited plan to send troops to the capital to put down the mutiny and to establish a martial law there. He himself decides that he's going to try to get back to the capital. However, it is increasingly unlikely that this is going to happen. His generals know for a fact that the men can't be trusted, A, to fire on other soldiers, which is never a popular choice for soldiers to make, and B, not to become part of the revolution. They convince the Tsar that really stepping down is the only thing he can possibly do, and going back to the capital will simply endanger his life. He tries to get back there, but never arrives. His train winds up in the small town of Pskov, where he's met by his senior commanders, General Alexeyev, General Ruski, who convince him, really, that the end is nigh. And it is the Tsar's chief of staff, his top general, Alexeyev, who really puts the kibosh on any chance of a counter-revolution. He orders the army not to advance anymore. And it's really the decision of the generals at the end of the day is unanimous in convincing the Tsar that he can't go on, that he must resign, and that he must abdicate. The Tsar receives telegrams from all the other front commanders agreeing the same thing, that there is nothing else that can be done, nothing else that could possibly placate the crowds, and any other decision would probably result in a civil war in Russia whilst also trying to fight the Germans. The Tsar writes into his abdication speech, into his declaration of abdication, that his haemophiliac son, Alexei, will not inherit the throne, because obviously he's not well enough to do that. And when the job is offered to Grand Duke Mikhail, the Tsar's brother, he wisely turns it down as well, fearing for his personal safety. So it is with Mikhail, really, that the Romanov line, after just over 304 years, ends, leaving Russia with an interesting question. What is to come next? How is Russia to be run? Who is to run it? And it is at this very point that Lenin is working out how best to get back to Russia to help answer some of those key questions. As soon as it was clear that the Tsar had abdicated and the revolution in Petrograd had been successful, that's the cue for the rest of the country to go into revolt. And the information to the rest of the country becomes readily available. And in cities really from the Baltic all the way through to the Pacific, symbols of Tsarism are smashed, and the Tsarist administrators and governors become under siege and are in fear of their lives. And this is in these towns and cities, the revolution appears to be a bit more organised and hasn't just happened spontaneously. And so the removal of the Tsar leads to a very quick collapse of the whole concept of Tsarism and the whole concept of autocracy across Russia. The policemen who had enforced the Tsar's rule, far more so than the soldiers — the soldiers are seen as we said, comrade Cossacks for the most part — but it's the policemen who have enforced the Tsar's rule, very quickly have to change their appearance, hide their uniforms, dress up as civilians, and go on the run. And many are brutally murdered. Anyway, that concludes our little talk about the February Revolution. I'm going to carry on with this theme and talk about the crises of the provisional government between March and October next time. But if obviously you want to know a bit more about this, you can contact me at www.explaininghistory.com. You can sign up for our newsletter, download one or other of our history ebooks on the subject of Russia, and become part of the dialogue. Let me know your thoughts. Anyway, more on this next time. Thanks very much, and bye bye.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.